You're listening to Strange by Nature, your guide to the strange, weird, unbelievable, and improbable wonders of the natural world.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here today. I am Kirk Mona, and I am joined today by Rachel Ginza and Victoria Thompson. We are all professional naturalists who together have scoured the world for weird and wonderful wonders just to please your mammalian brain's desire for novelty. Isn't that nice? Let's do this.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Oh, my gosh.
We've
got a fun one for you. Victoria is here this week. And of course, I got Rachel here with me. Wow. I just want to say right at the outset here, there are, as far as I know, no tapeworm stories in this week's show. I know you guys are sad at home. You wanted more tapeworm, but more tapeworm except for the ones that I just mentioned right now. Yeah. I'm not saying there never will be again. Just there's none in this show. You're safe.
For now.
We're gonna go a totally different direction. When I was little, like as in a kid, I think like a lot of kids, I thought dinosaurs were pretty cool. I was never like obsessed with them or anything, but they were just part of the landscape of childhood, which I think how it is for a lot of people. Sort of in the same way that other toys and things are. Like there's dinosaurs, there's trucks, superheroes, Star Wars. Like there's just these things that are like part of the landscape of childhood, and I was not obsessed with them, but I had dinosaur toys. Specifically, I used to play
with my brother's dinosaur toys.
Yeah, I had these things that so many of us had, the Ja Rule brand plastic dinosaurs, the little ones that like were just ubiquitous, probably because they were cheap. So like, here's the thing, if you're like, I need a toy, parents would be like, oh, this here, get these little plastic dinosaurs. They've been making them like forever. And the thing is, and I think some of us kids thought we were pretty smart for knowing this, even though the package may have said dinosaurs, not everything in the bag or the little tube was actually a dinosaur. Almost all of them weirdly had a Eunotherium in them, which is like a large rhino-like mammal from the Pleistocene, which is such a weird choice to include with dinosaurs, but like... And of all the Pleistocene animals to put in, not like a saber-toothed tiger or something most people heard of. No, the Eunotherium, that animal that is just, you know,
everyone on the tip knows, of everyone's obviously. Tongue. Yeah.
Right. I did have to look it up. I did not remember what it was.
I don't know what that is.
There, you can look at it. It looks like kind of like a weird-looking rhino. there was another animal included in sets like this that was actually period appropriate to the dinosaurs, but was not a dinosaur. And I want to know, can either of you, and you can play along at home, you can shout it out, we won't be able to hear you, but can anyone remember what the other animal that's often included that's not a dinosaur but is period correct to the dinosaurs?
Was it a pterosaur?
Ooh, it was indeed. Although, because, you know, I'm old school, when I was a kid, we called them
pterodactyls.
Right. Of course. And that's totally a disused name now and just shows that I'm old. They are pterosaurs. What's really funny though is like, pretty much of the scientific world stopped using the term or the name pterodactyl back in 1834. But like for some reason it stuck around.
We're all
and
like
just for the record, even though my kid would disagree, I'm not that old. The name was still seen and being used in kids' books like in the 1970s and 1980s. It really
1990s,
took like pop culture.
2000s.
90s is still pterodactyl, jeez.
Oh,
I was not a child then much anymore.
Sorry.
Like it took pop culture over 190 years to catch up to scientists. You know, no big deal. That's how it happens sometimes. So just to clarify what we're talking about here, pterosaurs are not dinosaurs. They were reptiles that lived alongside dinosaurs, but they are a distinct lineage of animals. It's sort of like how crocodiles were living during the time of the dinosaurs, but crocodiles are not dinosaurs either. They're just crocodilians. They're their own thing.
Right.
Pterosaurs did share a common ancestor with the dinosaurs, but they were distinct lineages that split from each other about 250 million years ago. So they've been distinct things from each other forever, basically, right? So Victoria and Rachel, some of our listeners may not be familiar with a pterosaur, I'm realizing. And I know there are many different species of them, but can you help out our listeners and try to describe a pterosaur the best you can? I'm curious what you come up with.
Okay, well, they have leathery wings.
I think of like a giant, like that's the big thing, right? Long snout. Yeah, okay, so I think of like a really big bat with their wings. I know some of
bat-like
them like
wings,
So they would have their hand or like their paws or whatever would be their like hands
whatever
or fingers
you want to call
them, would be, like on the ground. They could use those like the really big ones to help walk around.
Okay.
The wings go from their fingertips down or their wrists down to their ankles.
Yeah, they have a little claw. Yeah, okay. Claw on the top of their wing, leading edge of their wing.
Yeah, I think
generally have
like
a really long face with a really like big like back, like almost triangular, like conish shape or whatever for their skull.
Yeah. Like the shape of the skull, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the one thing some of them will have, and this is where it's kind of like depends on, some of them will have a crest of different sizes as well on top of their head. And that is sort of the classic, I mean, you both nailed it. Like, if you see an old school pterodactyl or a you know, if you watch Dinosaur Train for those of you who have small children and the pteranodons and stuff. Like, that's how what we have pictured these animals looking like, these pterosaurs looking like. And I think that's a pretty good description based on what we've always assumed, but based on some new-ish research that was published in the journal Nature, I would say both of you missed one really important feature that pterosaurs had. And when I heard this, it blew my mind. Based on fossil finds in Brazil, pterosaurs had feathers.
Yes!
Oh, yeah, nice.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love more dinosaurs with feathers. Yes!
But they're not even dinosaurs.
Well, I know
that's
not
what
dinosaurs.
Makes this so bizarre.
That's the whole point. But still, yes.
Like, and this is a really, really big deal. This is a bigger deal than finding dinosaurs with feathers, because again, these are not dinosaurs. Now, we'll say these were not flight feathers. They did fly using those big, like, skin flaps, like a bat, like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. But it now seems likely that their whole body was covered in downy feathers, and these were like straight up legit feathers. If you saw these, this has enormous implications. So first of all, we know that our modern birds we have today are descendants of dinosaurs, and we've now found feathered dinosaurs, and they mostly seem to be dinosaurs that were most closely related to birds. So like the theropod dinosaurs, that would be like things like T-Rex being the most famous example of a
velociraptors.
Yeah, velociraptors, dromaeosaurs, Utah raptors, stuff like that. And so we speculated that once those were found, we're like, okay, like feathers probably originated in some of the dinosaurs, but not all the dinosaurs, for things like warmth, and then eventually aided them in gliding and then flight, which
but
eventually gives us birds.
But if pterosaurs have them...
Yeah, that's deeply problematic, right?
Yeah. So, unless it's convergent evolution, but still, like...
Yeah, if pterosaurs were found with feathers, these pterosaurs were 113 million years old. And remember I said the last common ancestor between pterosaurs and dinosaurs was 250 million years ago. So it could very well be that that common ancestor also had
feathers.
Which, if that's the case, that would mean that probably most dinosaurs had feathers.
Yes.
And we just haven't found good fossil evidence yet. Feathers are, you have to have just the right conditions for feathers to fossilize. So we're going, oh my God. Like,
feather all the dinosaurs.
Yes!
Certainly the number of feathered dinosaurs has increased over the years. We keep on finding more and more that had feathers. And perhaps we now know that we need to look even further back for evidence of feathers. Feathers could be very, very old. Like, we used to think that feathers were a pretty new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be that feathers are much, much older than we ever thought, which is just awesome.
That's
and mind-blowing.
So cool.
And shows how we're still learning so much about the past. You know, like, this is a long time ago. It's very hard to find evidence. So this is very cool. Also fascinating.
I love talking about dinosaur feathers. It's so great.
Oh, me too.
I know. And we're learning more and more all the time. Also fascinating when it comes to pterosaurs was that these fossils were preserved with an amazing level of detail. Like, obviously, because you can see the feathers, but I'm talking amazing level of detail. When researchers were scanning these fossils with a very sensitive microscope and taking images, researchers were able to identify melanosomes in the feathers, which are basically the pigments.
Yes.
They can see the individual shapes of the pigments. So they didn't just have feathers.
They had
different colors of feathers. So for my entire life, our conception of a pterosaur has been this green, scaly, you know, leathery looking thing. And they were covered in feathers, probably in multiple bright colors of feathers. So our entire conception of what a pterosaur looked like just needs to be rethought and thrown out.
Oh, yeah.
The presence of colors also suggests that even way back 100-some million years ago, feathers were not just used for warmth, but likely used for signaling and communication between, you know, within the species, much like they are still used today. So it's like, oh my gosh.
Amazing.
Like, on the one hand, it's not surprising, like, because feathers are such a useful thing, both for signaling communication and for warmth, that it shouldn't be surprising that this is something that animals have had for a very, very, very long time. But it seems that this may be how do I want to phrase this carefully? It is suggestive of the idea that this is pushing back the date that we could conceivably find feathers, maybe all the way back to this common ancestor. But to be clear, we have not found feathers in a common ancestor, but it could be convergent evolution, like Rachel pointed out. But people are really, really excited about this.
That's so cool.
I think animals.
Well, and this just goes back to that episode I did a while back about, you know, dinosaur lips and all the ways that the conceptions we have based on skeletons.
Exactly.
A couple centuries of art is just completely wrong the more we find out.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, exactly. People who saw the taxidermist who had a walrus or whatever, that brought it back, but didn't show them a picture of a living walrus and were told, hey, can you stuff this? And they stuffed it super full, so it was just this big round thing instead of having all the wrinkles and stuff.
Yeah, the skin and the bones, and you're like, oh, we'll do our best.
Yep.
Animals from the past, you guys, are like, so fascinating because we really don't know exactly what they looked like you were saying. And like, if we now have to add on more soft tissue, which we don't have all the information on, and also add feathers into the mix, like you were saying, like, I don't know what these things looked like anymore. And artists have started to work on this and try to figure out what they looked like. But man, I want that time machine even more. It's so cool.
That'd be really cool.
As our techniques grow, so does our knowledge of the past. And it's likely we are progressively getting like better and better images by slowly, you know, cleaning off our backward looking lenses in a sense. We're getting greater detail as we go. And maybe that's a weird metaphor, but I think it's just strange to think that we have this image of the past and we know it's wrong, right? But we also know that it's getting better and clearer every year, every decade, every century. Like, and I think that's very cool that in one sense, the further we get from the past, the better we're getting at reconstructing it. Even though, I mean, the time scale is really tiny for humans.
Right,
it's just kind of funny that, like, yeah, the further we get from it, the better, you know, we get at knowing what it looked like. So, look, colorful feathered pterosaurs. Add that to your mental image of the age of the dinosaurs, right? It's pretty damn
amazing.
Cool. Sources this week were the journal Nature. There was an April 2022 article. It was called Pterosaur Melisome Support Signaling Functions for Early Feathers. There's also a really nice write-up on this in Science Alert in April 2022 as well, called Groundbreaking Study Confirms Pterosaurs Really Did Have Feathers, and That's Not All. So
that Science Alert.
There you go, yeah. Very cool. So that's what I want to share with you guys. And we'll take a quick break. And Rachel, you'll be back with us after the break with hopefully something fun and not tapewormy.
Yes.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Now, have either of you kept chickens?
No, but my parents-in-law do.
Yeah, when I moved into the current house I live in, there was a chicken coop for having chickens, and we promptly tore it apart and did not use it.
Okay, so fair, no. Fair. Now,
I get to...
Yeah.
I worked at an educational farm for a season, and as I just mentioned, my in-laws keep chickens, but I have never myself kept chickens.
There are chickens across the street from my house. My neighbors have them, and one of my friends raises them, so I've been around chickens.
Yeah, so have I. I also haven't raised chickens, and also where I am, lots of people raise chickens. And let me first say, I respect chickens. And I was laughing a little bit, Kirk, because when you were talking about dinosaurs and feathers and pterosaurs, because I wrote this before I knew what your topic was or anything, because I also think that chickens have a genetic memory of their ancestors that were dinosaurs. So I respect chickens,
they are dinosaurs.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, they are dinosaurs. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, chickens. So I digress. But a big part of raising chickens is pretty obvious. You have to feed them. You have to make sure that they stay warm. You got to make sure that they have a place to sleep. You have a nice little coop, have enough space, and make sure they get all their medications and things that they might need. But you also have to protect them from predators.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Now, around me, generally speaking, that's hawks, but it's also pine martens and fishers and coyotes and maybe even a bear here and there.
Wolves.
Wolves, foxes, feral cats.
Cars.
Well, not around here, but everywhere else. Yeah. So it's a wide variety of things you have to watch out for when you have chickens. So when this farmer, Frank Powling Sy, in Southern Australia, he's a brook trout farmer, but he has chickens, heard a commotion in his coop. First things first, you got to make sure your chickens are okay. So he went out to see what was happening. And sometimes, you know, chickens make a big commotion and it's over literally nothing. Something has fallen over to the side. This was not one of those times. He found some sort of spotted critter in his coop and a dead chicken. And doing what any farmer would do, he set a trap because it actually had escaped through a damaged little corner in the coop, so it had escaped. So he set out a trap.
Okay.
To see if he could catch it. And he did. He caught it.
Huh? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I can only think of one animal it could be at this point, but
Frank.
A Dalmatian.
Oh, wild time. He happened to catch the largest native carnivore in Australia, which, just to make things a little crazier, hadn't been seen in that part of Australia for over 130 years.
What? Yes, I heard this story.
Yeah. Awesome. I've had this on my docket for a while. He caught a spotted tail, also known as a tiger quoll. Now, I know what you're thinking. Spotted tail, spotted quoll, or a tiger quoll. Those are all the same creature. Tigers have stripes. This absolutely has spots. I don't know why it's called a tiger quoll.
Maybe not the best name, yeah.
Now, it's really cool that he was able to find and like catch it. And he took pictures of it both when it was in the coop and when he caught it. And people were like freaking out over the fact that he caught this because they hadn't had a documented sighting of this for a while, and they were actually able to take it in. He took it in to wildlife rehabbers or scientists or vet or whatever, and they actually like were able to test and see if it was just wild caught or anything like that, and they made sure it was healthy, and then they let it back out into the wild. in a more appropriate spot away from his coop.
Oh, okay.
But I wanted to talk a little bit about this tiger quoll. Now, there are 6 species of quoll in the world that are left. There are 4 on the mainland in Australia, and then there are 2 species in New Guinea. Generally speaking, size, they vary a lot by size, from 11 ounces to almost 8 pounds. So, okay. Big range of size. But the tiger quoll in general is from... So the one that Frank found is 4 to 7 pounds. In science, that's 1.8 to 3.5 kilograms. And it is the second largest carnivorous marsupial ever. It's right
after
behind
the Tasmanian tiger.
After the Tasmanian devil.
Yeah.
That's still around anyway. Because we don't have Tasmanian tigers.
Because the Tasmanian tiger
anymore.
Would be bigger, but they're...
Yeah.
Now, I think they look really cute. They've also been called the native cat. They are kind of cat-like. They remind me a little bit of martens, actually, or fishers. They have very, like, elongated faces, kind of weaselish looking face. They have brown fur with white spots all over the body, not just the tail. And honestly, they look really, really cute. I'm not going to lie. He caught it. He actually contacted South Australia's National Parks and Wildlife Service to help catch the tiger quoll. And they took it back and figured out what to do or figured out what it was and took it for testing and everything.
Gotcha.
They're pretty cool. They're not sure if it's like a relic population or anything like that. It's just really far away from where it would normally be found. Which is wild.
Wow. Interesting.
One thing I wanted to mention about the tiger quoll, so they're not very big. They're a little bit longer. They have a really like thick tail, like a little thicker than like a cat tail or anything. But I wouldn't want to mess with them because they in relation to body size, they have the second most powerful bite in the animal kingdom.
Oh,
the second most powerful bite.
Wow, really?
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So, like,
what's the first?
You do that with the fact that they're arboreal, and my brain immediately goes to drop bears, and I'm out. Which is not the same thing at all.
Wow. So, like, that's relative to body size. And for a mammal, that's really huge. I mean, it's not probably anything compared to like alligators and polar bears and stuff like that. But those are massive animals. This is for an animal that small, that is very impressive.
Yeah, like I was looking at like pictures and everything, and they truly, I don't even think they get a foot off the ground. They look like little angry cats, like a house cat. So like truly they're not that big, but to have that kind of bite force is pretty impressive. And because they're arboreal, their toes, actually like their back toes, kind of split in half so that where they're better able to hold on to like branches and everything.
Okay.
They kind of remind me of tree kangaroos, but like thinner. Anyway.
Yeah.
I didn't have a ton to talk about for quolls. I just wanted to talk about the fact that someone found one by accident in their chicken coop and they hadn't been seen in over 130 years. It's a wild thing to just
happen upon. That is a strange way to rediscover an animal. Yeah
good so, thing he had a live trap instead of
thank God.
Another kind of trap.
Yeah, so my sources this week, I used the Miami Herald had a really good article, as well as The Guardian. And then I learned a little bit more with A to Z Animals, as well as Bush Heritage Australia. So
cool, thank you.
We're going to take a bit of a break, and when we return, it'll be Victoria.
All right, we're back. Sometime in 2019 or thereabouts, near Portland, Maine, a 23-year-old man was found unresponsive on a farm where he worked and rushed to the hospital.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear.
On the way there, he suffered multiple tonic-clonic seizures, which is the...
That's the bad one.
That's the grand mal seizures, yeah.
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 And
yikes. At
the, yeah, not good. At the hospital, he was delirious. He was suffering from rhabdomyolysis, which is when your muscles break down and basically like the gunk in your bloodstream from the muscle breakdown clogs up your kidneys and sometimes your heart.
Oh my gosh. Not good.
So he was nearing kidney failure. And at first they suspected that it was some kind of viral encephalitis.
Yeah,
so they took various samples of blood, urine, cerebrospinal fluid, and they also did some imaging of his brain, and everything turned up negative.
What?
There did not seem to be any infectious agent. Yeah, like they did cultures. Oh, they didn't see anything in the scans. So because he didn't seem to have an infection, they took him off all of the antibiotics and antivirals they'd put him on.
Okay.
And he actually gradually started to get better with a lot of fluids.
Okay.
Okay.
And he was discharged from the hospital around the 5th or 6th day after his admission.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay.
Without knowing why this happened in the first
like,
place. Okay.
Yeah. And he had suffered some amnesia, but they had been interviewing him and he denied using any kind of street drugs. He couldn't remember any injury. He could not remember being exposed to any chemicals on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
But as he continued, good candidates there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. As he continued to recover, he finally remembered something.
Ooh.
On the morning of the day he fell ill, he had made himself a tea from some valerian root that he had foraged in a nearby stream.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he poisoned himself.
Valerian is a plant that is used in herbal medicine as a sleep aid. It's generally considered safe. He had identified the plant himself using the internet.
Nope.
Mm-mm. And helpfully, he still had some of the leaves in his car, which a local plant expert identified not as valerian, but as Cicuta maculata, the spotted water hemlock.
Oh.
That's kind of what I thought.
There it is. Good job.
Hemlock is not something you want to eat.
So there are 4 species of water hemlock. They're all native to North America, and they are pretty much the most toxic plants found on this continent.
Kirk, yeah. I found it at your workplace.
Yes, indeed. Frankly, this young man was lucky to survive his poisoning. There are many cases in the literature where people ate this plant and died. So water hemlock is related to the famous poison hemlock of Eurasia. That's what poisoned Socrates. And they are both part of the family Apiaceae. Unfortunately for humans, this is the family that is also known as the carrot family.
Yeah.
So, yeah, these horribly toxic plants are in the same family with carrots, also parsnips, celery, and parsley, as well as caraway, anise, cilantro, coriander, cumin, dill, fennel, and many other herbs and vegetables. So... Mm-hmm. Also, the well-known roadside flower, Queen Anne's Lace, which is also known as wild carrot, also in this family.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, so the distinctive feature that this family of plants has is the umbrella-shaped flowers. And there's a certain similarity to the leaves of a lot of the species. They're often, like, divided. And if you think about, like, carrot leaves and celery leaves and parsley, like, flat-leaf parsley leaves and cilantro leaves, they all have kind of a similar thing going on. You can kind think about... That's typical of that family.
Okay.
As an aside, some members of this family, including some edible ones like parsnip, can cause a horrible, severe rash when skin that has touched the plant sap is then later exposed to sunlight.
Thinking wild parsnip.
It's called phytophotodermatitis. Wild parsnip is a very invasive plant that's taken over a lot of roadside and meadow areas in this country. And you can get yourself some nasty burns from that.
Mm-hmm.
So be careful. Even though you can't eat the root, because it's a parsnip. Wear gloves. Yeah. Interestingly, valerian is not in this family at all. Although it does look superficially similar in some ways. But in terms of the look, water hemlocks look pretty typical of this family. They have rounded clusters of small white flowers in an umbrella shape. They grow about 1 to 2 meters tall. In fact, they look pretty similar to Queen Anne's lace or wild parsnip, although wild parsnip has yellow flowers. So it's easy to see how people who are foraging for edible wild plants, such as wild parsnip, carrot and parsnip, might be tricked if they don't know what they're doing. The poison in these plants is called cicutoxin, and it acts as a stimulant of the central nervous system, causes seizures, as discussed, brain swelling, problems with heart rhythm, rhabdomyolysis, kidney failure, problems with blood acidity and coagulation, as well as delirium and hallucination. So just bad news all around.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, yeah. Oh boy, don't
seems
eat
like
that,
a
kids.
Bad way to go.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no antidote.
Oh, so he's yes. really just very lucky. Got it.
Yes. The first treatment is activated charcoal if they think there's anything left still in the stomach. And then the focus is basically on controlling the seizures mainly, usually with benzodiazepines and otherwise supportive treatment for any other symptoms. There was actually another case in Maine from 1992 where two adult brothers were foraging and ate from some water hemlock root. The younger brother took 3 bites and the older brother took 1 bite. And although they were able to get to a hospital, the younger brother died 3 hours after eating the plant. And the older brother got sick, but ultimately survived. So it is quite dose dependent. Yeah. So as you were saying, Rachel, foraging is really fun. I don't want to discourage people from foraging, but
no, it's
you
a great
really
time.
Have to know what you're doing. You have to know
go
what
ahead.
You're
discourage people just a little bit. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Go with someone
I'm encouraging people
doing.
To be careful. Yes. Something
check.
I've drilled into my kids from an early age is you do not put any plants in your mouth that you find out in the wild unless mama tells you it's okay. And unless I'm absolutely certain of the identification, I'm not going to say it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And some adults either never learned this lesson or didn't absorb it, unfortunately for them. So, you know, many of these species are pretty common, and I have seen spotted water hemlock a few times in locations that are easily accessible to children. As you mentioned, Rachel, it's on the site of the place where Kirk and you and I all used to work together, and Kirk still works. Oh, one yeah. case I saw it right by the main dock.
I remember that. I was there when you found
yep.
it.
Yep.
I try to not eat it when I'm, you know, working.
Yeah.
Or touch it.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually my parents-in-law who live in Massachusetts and raise chickens have some on their property. So I did tell my children never, never touch that plant when we're visiting grandma and grandpa. But, you know, there are case reports of children being poisoned by using the hollow stem as a whistle. Like,
oh no.
Oh, boy. There's this common idea in our culture that natural things are good for you, or at least like better for you than things made by humans. We've talked about many, many examples on this show that put the lie
nature
to that idea.
Does not
and here's
care
another
about
one.
You.
Yeah, nature doesn't care about you. Sometimes nature wants to kill you. Mm-hmm. My sources this week were the 2019 case report from the Journal of the Maine Medical Center by Blue Butterfield et al., Newcomb's Wildflower Guide, the CDC, and Wikipedia.
But not the first edition of the Wildflower Guide.
No.
No.
Never buy the first edition if you're going to go foraging.
No.
I don't know about the first
important.
Edition.
Well, no, not that one. Just if you're buying a book about wild edibles, the joke is always you never buy the first edition because they haven't gotten all the errors out yet.
Okay.
So silly.
Point taken.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
All right. That's what I have this week. It was good talking to you guys.
Yeah.
Great to be here.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks everyone for listening to today's show. Be sure to subscribe. New episodes drop every Wednesday, and we love sharing this strange world with all of our listeners. If you would be so kind as to leave us a 5-star review, that would be great. It lets other lovers of the strange discover the show. You can reach out to us on social media by searching for Strange by Nature Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can send us an email as well. Our address is contact@strangebynaturepodcast.com. If you want more information about the show, you can also check out our website, which is strangebynaturepodcast.com. Until next week, get outside, stay curious, and embrace the strange.